Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, good evening.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And I'm Leo. And tonight we will we have an interview with Gail Corey Tomsing, she's the founder of the cornerreport.com as a blog, and she's also a reporter for Indian Times magazine. But she's tonight we're going to talk about the Palestinian eviction from Palestinians. Eviction from Jerusalem and the Palestinian right of return problem, and that they're having, and the horrendous problems that are going on still in the Gaza. But what we wanted to do.
We'll start off with some news and then we'll bring you the interview.
Yeah, I thought that would be cool.
Okay, and in reference to that, to the news, Gordon Brown is snubbed by soldiers. It's a curtain protest. Gordon Brown was subbed by badly injured Afghan veterans when they closed curtains around their beds during a hospital visit and refused to speak to him. More than half the soldiers being treated at the Selly Oak Hospital ward in Birmingham either asked for the curtains to be closed or deliberately avoided the Prime Minister, according to several of those present. The soldiers, who have sustained some of the worst injuries seen in Afghanistan, describe his visit as opportunistic and a waste of time. Furious about equipment shortage and poor compensation for their injuries, one soldier said, "It is almost as if we are the product of an unwanted affair. He has done nothing for us." Brown visited the military wing of Selly Oak on September 2nd, where about 25 wounded soldiers were being treated. They were told about the visit in the morning and were asked by nurses if they wanted to speak to him. Sapper Matthew Weston, 20, is one of the most seriously injured soldiers to have survived. He lost both legs and his right arm when a bomb exploded on a dirt track outside of Sangin. He said, "I don't want to speak to him. I don't want to waste my time talking to someone who is just trying to make themselves look good. I'll spend the day with my family instead." Half the lads don't want to speak to him, and those that did pretty much blamed him for everything. Many of the lads just closed their curtains and hid themselves away. Actually, the visit was on September 2nd, although this article was written on December 6th. It just shows you how the British soldiers feel about their government and the war.
I got one here that we should bring up. Copenhagen climate summit scam unveiled, and it says the UN Copenhagen climate talks are in disarray today after developing countries reacted furiously to leaked documents that show world leaders will next week be asked to sign an agreement. Hands over power to rich countries and sidelines the UN's role in all future climate change negotiations. The document is also being interpreted by developing countries as setting unequal limits on per capita carbon emissions for developed and developing countries in 2050, meaning that people in rich countries would be permitted to emit nearly twice as much under the proposals. And hang on 1 second, we'll continue this. The so-called Danish text, a secret draft agreement worked on by a group of individuals known as the Circle of Commitment, but understood to include the UK, US, and Denmark, has only been shown to a handful of countries since it was finalized this week. The agreement leaked to The Guardian newspaper is a departure from the Kyoto Protocol's principle that rich nations, which have emitted the bulk of the CO2, would take on firm and binding commitments to reduce greenhouse gases, while poorer nations were not compelled to act. The draft hands effective control of climate change finance to the World Bank, and would abandon the Kyoto Protocol, the only legally binding treaty that the world has on emissions reductions, and would make any money to help poor countries adapt to climate change dependent on them taking a range of actions. The document was described last night by one senior diplomat as a very dangerous document for developing countries. It's a fundamental reworking of the UN balance of obligations and it is being superimposed without discussion on the talks. A confidential analysis of the text by developing countries, also seen by The Guardian, shows deep unease over details of the text. In particular, it is understood to force developing countries to agree to specific emission cuts and measure that were not part of the original UN agreement.
Divide poor countries further by creating a new category of developing countries called the most vulnerable.
And weaken the UN's role in handling climate finance.
Not allow poor countries to emit more than 1.44 tons of carbon per person by 2050, while allowing rich countries to emit 2.6 tons.
This is out-and-out genocide here. And developing countries that have seen the text are understood to be furious that it is being promoted by rich countries without their knowledge and without discussion in the negotiations. It is being done in secret, clearly intention to get back, to get Barack Obama and the leaders of other rich countries to muscle it through when they arrive next week. It effectively is the end of the UN process, said one diplomat who asked to remain nameless.
Antonio Hill, a climate policy advisor for the Oxfam International, says, "This is only a draft, but it highlights the risk that when the big countries come together, the smaller ones get hurting. On every count, the emission cuts need to be scaled up. It allows too many loopholes, and it does not suggest anything like 40% cuts that science is saying is needed." Hill continued, "It proposes a green fund to be run by a board, but the big risk is that it will be run by the World Bank and the Global Environment Facility, a partnership of 10 agencies, including the World Bank and the UN Environment Program, and not the UN. That would be a step backwards, and it tries to put constraints on developing countries when none were negotiated in earlier UN climate talks. The text was intended by Denmark and rich countries to be a working framework, which may be adapted by countries over the next week. It is particularly inflammatory because it sidelines the UN negotiating process and suggests that rich countries are desperate for world leaders to have a text to which to work from when they arrive next week. Few numbers or figures are included in the text because these would be filled in later by world leaders. However, it seeks to hold temperature rises to 2C and mentions the sum of $10 billion a year to help poor countries adapt to climate change from 2012 to 2015. This article was amended on the 9th of December, 2009.
That was just a footnote.
I just thought maybe.
But really fascinating, though, that they've already.
Go back down. Go back down to the end there. All the way to the bottom. Go all the way to the bottom. I just want to see how much we have to pay. It seeks to $10 billion a year to help poor countries to adapt to climate change.
But the interesting thing was is that back in, a few months back, I read something that Biden and Obama had agreed to pay $65 billion toward to work with some with a poverty. World Poverty Fund or something or other, that was a deal. And now they got this thing. I mean, it's really
they're
something.
Not very clear about
they're
what they're
clear,
doing.
And most of this stuff doesn't get out. This is something interesting. This is a quickie here that I'm going to. This is a John Lennon opinion about overpopulation. I thought this was pretty good.
Yeah, let's see.
He said over 35 years ago, the big media scare was overpopulation. We were all doomed. Then it was the coming ice age that was going to kill everyone. Now we're all going to die of global warming. Kind of typical that Lennon didn't follow the mainstream thought. And it's about a 1 minute. It's John Lennon and Yoko.
I want to know how you, as a woman, feel about overpopulation in the world and its relation to polluting the environment.
How does Yoko feel about overpopulation? As a woman, at least.
Yeah. Well, I think the problem is not overpopulation as people believe to be, but it's more of the balance of things. What, you know, like food, some part of the world is wasted of food, and in some parts, you know, nobody has food. And that kind of balance, if that is solved, I don't think we need to be worried so much about overpopulation.
I think it's a bit of a joke the way people have made this overpopulation thing into a kind of myth. I don't really believe it, you know. I think whatever happens will balance itself out and work itself out. It's all right for us all living saying, oh, well, there's enough of us, so we won't have any more. Don't let anybody else live. I don't believe in that. I think we've got enough food and money to feed everybody. And I think the natural balance, even though old people will last longer, I'm sure there's enough room for us, and some of them can go to the moon anyway.
You mean you think there's enough, if it were...
Yeah, I don't believe overpopulation, you know. I think that's just a kind of myth that government has thrown out to keep your mind off Vietnam and Ireland and all the important subjects.
Oh, I think you're wrong about that.
Oh, I don't care.
yes.
Miss John Lennon.
He was
the last of the great liberals.
I love that he said, I don't care.
I don't care, yeah. But there's one more. Since tonight we're going to have be talking to Gail Townsend about Palestine.
The Palestinian situation.
And some of this dealing with the settlers.
U.S. cash behind Israel's extremist settlers. Last month, a Brooklyn-based nonprofit organization called the Hebron Fund, which supports Jewish settlers in the Israeli-occupied city of Hebron, held a fundraiser at the New York Mets Stadium, Citi Field. The fundraiser went forward despite calls for its cancellation from grassroots human rights organizations from the U.S., Palestine, and Israel. The fact that the Hebron Fund likely raised hundreds of thousands of dollars for extremist Israeli settlers at a major U.S. venue with little public scrutiny is a troubling sign for those who hope that the U.S. can play a constructive role in achieving a just peace in the Middle East. Let's see, we'll go to the rest of this article. Perhaps more worryingly, according to the Washington Post, columnist David Ignatius, a search of IRS records identified 28 U.S. charitable groups that made a total of $33.4 million in tax-exempt contributions to settlements and related organizations between 2004 and 2007. Some of the larger organizations, including Friends of the Eretz Konim and Friends of Ir David, both leading the Jewish settlers takeover of Palestine, East Jerusalem, are based in New York City. Israeli settlements violate the Geneva Convention prohibition against an occupying power transferring its population into occupied territory, and Israeli settlements expansion directly contradicts the U.S. call for a settlement freeze. Hebron's Jewish settlers, who are supported by the Hebron Fund, are openly fundraising in New York City. Under the protection of the Israeli military, they are expanding settlements in Hebron's old city and driving out the Palestinian residents.
The Hebron's fund extremist positions are clear. Hebron Fund Executive Director Yossi Bomo told the American Prospect that democracy is poison to Arabs. Israel must not give Arabs a say in how the country is run. And you'll never get the truth out of an Arab. Hebron's chief rabbi, Dov Lahr, a featured participant in some Hebron Fund events, recently praised a new book that says it is permitted for a Jew to kill civilians who provide moral support to an enemy of the Jews, and to even kill young children. It is foreseeable that they will grow up to become enemies.
Settlers and the Israeli army routinely attack and terrorize Palestinians in Hebron, according to human rights groups such as Beit HaSalim in Israel. In 1994, Hebron settler Baruch Goldstein massacred 29 unarmed Palestinians who were praying in a Hebron mosque. One of the honorees at the 2009 Hebron Fund dinner, Naomi Arnon, called Goldstein an extraordinary person in 1995. In 1990, Arnon called the three Jewish terrorists who were convicted of killing three Palestinians and maiming two Palestinian mayors heroes. Through the Hebron Fund, though the Hebron Fund tells the IRS that its purpose is to promote social and educational well-being, in 2008, Baumol assured New York radio listeners, There are real facts on the ground that are created by people helping the Hebron Fund and coming to our dinners.
In 2007, Appeal explained dozens of new families can now come live in Hebron and waiting for you to be their partners in the redemption of Hebron. And Bamal dedicated the 2009 fundraiser to protesting at racist limitations led by President Barack Obama on Jewish growth. And
settlers frequently claim that preventing Jews from living anywhere they want in the Israeli-occupied West Bank is racist, regardless of the settlers' severe infringement on the rights of the long-standing Palestinian residents. Settlers justify the takeover of Hebron by involving the massacre of 60... by invoking the massacre of 67 Jewish residents of Hebron by Palestinians in 1929. But rather than equality, Hebron settlers aim for superior rights enforced from the barrel of a gun. Nonprofit organizations like the Hebron Fund play a substantial role in fueling the Middle East conflict, but largely fly under the radar in the U.S. They brazenly hold public fundraisers, and the media generally ignore them. Major U.S. advocacy organizations that claim to oppose Israeli settlements typically fail to criticize them. In one RAM mainstream media report, David Ignatius highlighted the U.S. government's self-defeating policy, writing that critics of Israeli settlements question why American taxpayers are supporting indirectly through the exempt contributions, a process that the government condemns.
That's good. That's good. But and until the public advocacy groups, media, and the U.S. government scrutinize the RAIN and settlement nonprofits like the Hebron Fund, policy statements about peace in the Middle East will do nothing to stop the daily violence and dispossession of suffered by Palestinians. And so then that's how it ends. And so it's a pretty sick situation, folks.
Mm-hmm.
It just is. And
that was from The Guardian, a UK.
Not from
an American newspaper.
But the British are pretty sick of this as well. And if you want to get any information about the United States, you have to go to Europe.
Okay, let's see if there's anything more here.
Copenhagen Commons.
No, we read a lot about that yesterday. Every appointee to the American government must endure a thorough background check by the American Jewish community. In the case of Obama's government in particular, every criticism against Israel made by a potential government appointee has become a catalyst for debate about whether appointing another leftist offers proof that Obama does not truly support Israel. A few months ago, boisterous protests by the American Jewish community helped foil the appointment of Chaz Freeman to chair the National Intelligence Council, citing his anti-Israel leanings. The next attempt to appoint an intelligence aide, in this case, former Republican Senator Chuck Hagel, also resulted in vast criticism over his not having a pro-Israel record. American Zionists are urging Obama to cancel Hagel's appointment because of what they call a long-standing and problematic record of hostility toward Israel.
It's just amazing.
Here's something. The police youth corps.
This is 5 minutes, and we can run this if you want. Police youth corps confronted at parade in Florida, I believe.
Yep.
Let's see. We can play this for a while. See what it is. We are changed. Tampa confronts police youth force. We got any talk here?
Let's see.
Did you guys do policing or something, or what is it?
Not
so are you guys like part of the youth corps or something? A youth police force?
It's part Boy Scouts.
Like Boy Scouts? So like Boy Scouts are turning in police or something like that?
It's just to help people who
are you like academy or something like that?
Very similar to it.
Academy?
We all tied in with the Department of Home Security.
Guys, go ahead and line up. Green shirts and back.
So you guys just patrolling around here or something like that?
Yeah, we're looking for lost kids.
Lost kids around here?
Back up to the grass.
So, guys, how old are you? Like 15
between
stuff?
Between the age of 14 and 19.
So, you guys are turning in police forces or something like that?
No.
Are you really, like, part of the police department or anything like that?
We are affiliated with it, but we are not police. We don't have the power.
But why do you have the police jacket on?
It's the floor jacket.
So, would you do things like police officers or something like that?
You can ride along with officers. We can't carry weapons. We can't arrest them. We don't have those powers.
So, do you, like, spy around and stuff? Like, do spying or something like that?
No.
You just look for children or something like that?
I just
remember
the runaways in their
game. Have you guys heard about how Homeland Security is recruiting Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts?
It's interesting that they have...
we have police explorers here.
I know, but, you know, it's kind of like... You know, if you look at what happened back in the days... And I heard recently that... there was an article recently that has some information about the Boy Scouts being trained in hand-to-hand combat and all these other things.
Oh.
But I wanted to mention this, since the Boy Scouts was possibly mentioned this as... this is from Mail Online, which is the Daily Mail Britain paper. Scouts founder Baden-Powell was a war criminal who had tribal chief executed illegally. The founder of the Scouts, meaning the Boy Scouts, Lord Baden-Powell, had been accused of being a war criminal who illegally executed an African warrior chief. Baden-Powell, who will forever be associated with the scouting movement, which he founded in 1907, is accused of ordering the execution of a tribal chief against the orders of his superiors while serving in Africa with the army in 1986. He even altered his diary entries to reflect his version of the story, claiming that Uwini, the leader of the tribe of Matabeleland, now Zimbabwe, was captured in battle rather than surrendering. And Uwini was a leader of the uprising, which followed a rebellion where more than 300 British settlers were killed. He claimed to have magical powers which protected him from gunfire. However, he was put to death by a firing squad after he was captured. And Baden-Powell, rather, is accused of ignoring a promise made to Uwini to spare his life if he surrendered peacefully, as well as dismissing an order to hand him over to civilian authorities. And instead, Uwini was placed before a military tribunal, which the Sunday Times reported was not presented with the full facts of his capture and then shot by a firing squad. And Baden-Powell was later cleared by an inquiry and later said he had been released from the army without a stain on his character. But his biographer, Tim Geale, called this a most shameful episode in his life, which has been much praised ever since. Baden-Powell was tasked with protecting 3,000 settlers who were farming in the area, under attack from rebels who were hiding in caves. But so that was the leader of the Scouts, and you know, it's a minor issue, but
not to the guy that got killed.
Not to Uwini, the leader. But anyway, I thought that was interesting. And we'll probably get a few more minutes, but Bush Obama war.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, June. Oh.
During his speech at West Point, in which he announced the war's escalation, he said, "The Taliban is ruthless, repressive, and radical movement. What he, or John McCain, or George Bush never bothers to tell you is that this is the same Taliban that the U.S. government supported back when it was fighting Soviet forces in Afghanistan." Obama also said, "We are bringing the Iraq war to a responsible end." That is a lie. U.S. forces will stay in Iraq indefinitely. Obama has no more intention of bringing all U.S. troops out of Iraq than he does bringing them home from Afghanistan. Beyond that, there are more private contractors, mercenaries, operating in Iraq than U.S. troops. And this will likely be the case in Afghanistan as well. Let's see.
Is this the same one?
Doesn't look like. Oh, here it is. But not only did Obama escalate the war in Afghanistan, he made it clear that he is prepared to extend the war into Pakistan. Obama's speech was laced with references to Pakistan. Examples: our security is at stake in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Our overarching goal remains the same, to disrupt, dismantle, and defeat al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan. We need a strategy that works on both sides of the Afghanistan-Pakistan border.
But there's a note here also that says that the latest reports state there are no more than 100 al-Qaeda forces in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the whole thing is like a joke. You know, it's just a way to continue the military industrial complex and to make huge profits on a bogus war, kill a lot of people, take over their country.
Obama even intimated that he was prepared to extend the war well beyond Pakistan. He told the West Point cadets the struggle against violent extremism will not be finished quickly and extends well beyond Afghanistan and Pakistan. Just how far beyond Afghanistan and Pakistan Obama intends to extend the war, he did not say. But there is no question he is fully prepared to broaden the war even further. Obama even had the unmitigated gall to criticize the Afghan government for being hampered by corruption and the drug trade. Need I remind readers that for all its faults, when the Taliban controlled Afghanistan, there was virtually no drug trade coming out of Afghanistan. For all intents and purposes, the Taliban destroyed the drug business in Afghanistan. Opium and drug production only returned to Afghanistan after U.S. forces displaced the Taliban. In fact, drug production in Afghanistan takes place right under the noses, no pun intended, with the passive compliance of U.S. forces. But there is even more evil and sinister motive for the perpetual war than drug smuggling. Perpetual war is a tool of globalists to enslave us. Under the rubric of the war on terror, big governmental elitists are able to dismantle the constitutional safeguards of our freedoms. Without 9/11 and the war on terror, there would be no Patriot Act, for example. That's true.
And remember, the Patriot Act was the first proposed during the Clinton administration, but a recalcitrant Republican Congress refused to approve it. But with a Republican in the White House, G.W. Bush, who's the same Republican, easily passed the Patriot Act into law. And to show you how this partisanship stuff works, those same Democrats who tried to pass the Patriot Act in the 90s, called by a different name, of course, voted against the Patriot Act when they proposed by Republicans in the early 2000s. And
since we're on the Patriot Act, don't hold your breath waiting for a Democratic Congress or the Democratic Barack Obama to expunge it.
Yeah, you voted for the FISA bill.
Yep.
You voted, I mean, it's a farce. It's an absolute farce.
Now think it through. First, the Democrats tried to pass the Patriot Act under a different name, and Republicans opposed it. Next, the Republicans, who once opposed it, passed the Patriot Act, and Democrats, who once opposed it. Now, both Democrats and Republicans, who have both opposed and proposed it, accept and embrace the Patriot Act. And with all that political posturing and grandstanding aside, the Patriot Act is only law today because we are at war. Without war, we would not have the Department of Homeland Security, which cannot even keep uninvited people out of the White House. The Transportation Security Administration and thousands of laws and regulations that trample constitutionally protected liberties. In the name of war, our government can record our phone calls, read our emails, monitor our financial transactions and movements, and even place an Army Combat Division, U.S. NORTHCOM, on American soil to watch or even fight against us. And some of you don't even give it a second thought. Why? We are at war. I know, Obama promises to begin the transfer of our forces out of Afghanistan in July of 2011. Do you really believe that? Do you really believe that we're going to spend trillions of dollars on the war effort and send more than 50,000 troops plus thousands of independent contractors and ship millions of tons of equipment halfway around the world and then turn around and bring them all back in 18 months? I might have been born in the morning, but it was not yesterday morning. Of course, that brings up another purpose globalists have in keeping us at war. The financial cost of waging war keeps the country in debt and keeps the Fed printing presses running.
All right. So this one continues, but
this is a great article.
Yeah, I suggest you go to it. It's by Chuck Baldwin and
LouRockwell.com.
Yeah, Lou Rockwell brings in some good stuff. LouRockwell.com. And okay, let's go back. We're going to go to the interview here. It's about half an hour, and maybe a little over. But we'll begin that now. That's with Gail Corey Townsend, and over the Palestinian right of return and so on. So
I think you'll find it interesting.
I hope so.
Oh, good. Can you speak up a little bit?
Yeah,
we can hardly hear you.
Well, let me turn off my heater. That might help.
Oh, yeah, that's a lot better. You were speaking more directly into your phone. We can hear you better now.
There you go. How's that?
Oh, much better. No, keep your heater on. We don't want you to freeze.
Just speak into the phone.
Just speak directly into your phone. That's all you have to do. I know tonight we asked you to come on and to talk a little bit about what's happening in Palestine, in the West Bank and in Jerusalem, especially concerning the Palestinian right of return. There seems to be an escalation of the taking of Palestinians' homes. Do you find that to be true?
Yeah. You know, at the end of last month, the Prime Minister of the Zionist entity, known as Israel, made a declaration that he made a big sacrifice and that it was really hard to do, but they were going to freeze settlement expansion for 10 months.
Right.
Now, all settlements in the West Bank are illegal under international law. That ruling has been reiterated time and time again through United Nations resolutions and most recently through the International Court of Justice in 2004, which ruled that both the wall, the gigantic wall of the apartheid wall of hatred, as I call it, and all of the settlements are illegal. So whenever the Israelis make this big, you know, confession or this big protestation of the big sacrifice that they're making by giving up something, it's nonsense. I mean, it's totally bogus. So not only did he say he was going to freeze settlements for 10 months, I think 3 days later, it was revealed that, in fact, they weren't going to actually freeze. They didn't mean that they were going to stop public buildings.
Uh-huh.
They approved 28 new public buildings, and it didn't mean that they were going to stop construction on settlements that had already started, and it didn't mean that they were going to stop beginning construction on settlements that had already been contracted. So in fact, it didn't mean that there was going to be a settlement freeze for 10 months anyway. And then a few days after that, Netanyahu said, well, after the 10 months, we're going to just start up settlements again anyway.
Well, what bothers me so much was the, what really bothered me was the evictions of the Palestinians out of their homes in Jerusalem.
I saw
a few videos on this, and I was like absolutely appalled. I was like, you know, what kind of monsters would do this stuff? You know what I mean? Monsters.
Monsters.
Well, my understanding was that this is wrapped up with the idea of the right of return. Although Israelis can hold dual citizenship, they can visit countries whenever they want and come back to their homes, the same freedom is not guaranteed to the Palestinians. They leave their homes for any prolonged length of time, and Israel comes in and takes them.
Well, not only takes them, but they've been knocking them down.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like, you've seen the pictures, and it's absolutely...
Yeah, it's horrendous. It's absolutely horrendous. And yet, you know, our government says absolutely nothing.
Well, so does the rest of the world.
And the rest of the world. You know, well, I can't say that, because I know that there was just a... I mean, the UN has been all over this thing, but there hasn't been any kind of
repercussions,
behind it.
Right.
You know, nobody's doing anything, and it's just a horrendous... It's a genocide.
I saw a YouTube clip where a family was sitting out in front of their house. They were on the street. It was a mother and father and a couple of children, and they had lived there for two or three generations.
That's Absolutely. And what the Israelis do is they come in and say, you don't have a permit for this house, so get out.
And that, yeah, and this wasn't even that. This was these were some crooked...
I was hoping I'd have another video for you or an audio for you, but unfortunately my interview is going to be abrupted here. I have something here I might... just give me 1 second, folks. Sorry, folks. Can't seem to find anything that I want to read. The last thing I expected was for this to blow up. I should have expected it, but I didn't. There's one. While the EPA declares the gas, here I'm going to do... read this article. Get it? Okay, this is by Prison Planet. EPA says breathing is deadly, but radioactive drinking water is good for us. Environmental Protection Agency says gas that humans exhale is a threat to public health, yet uranium and arsenic-poisoned water is perfectly nutritious. While the EPA declares the gas that we exhale to be a deadly poison, as protesters at the Copenhagen decry the suffering of polar bears as their population figures increase to record levels, and as their population figures increase to record levels, delegates in the Danish capital warn of dastardly peril of cow farting. A New York Times report confirming that U.S. drinking water contains dangerous levels of arsenic, uranium, and other radioactive substances barely gets noticed. Furthermore, the new study shows that the Environmental Protection Agency knew that water systems all over the United States were contaminated with dangerous levels of numerous toxic substances, yet failed to publish the vast majority of water authorities involved. Since the environmental movement is completely hijacked by globalists hell-bent on world government and devastated carbon taxes, real environmental problems have been swept aside as the contrived scam of man-made global warming swallows up the attention. Our drinking water is contaminated with toxic waste, our food supply is poisoned by genetically modified garbage, and our consumer products are laced with cancer-causing chemicals. But who cares, right? Surely all this pales in comparison to the effort to stop the world warming by a percentage of a degree over the next 100 years. More than 20% of the nation's water treatment systems have violated key provisions of the Safe Drinking Water Act over the last 5 years, according to New York Times analysts of federal data. That law requires communities to deliver safe tap water to local residents. But since 2004, the water provided to more than 49 million people has contained illegal concentrations of chemicals like arsenic, radioactive substances like uranium, as well as dangerous bacteria often found in sewage. But unlike the mammoth threat posed by the life-giving gas carbon dioxide, which the EPA yesterday classified as a health threat, the same humans that exhale it, the Environmental Protection Agency is noticeably less concerned about the fact that our water is filled with contaminants that are linked to millions of instances of illness within the United States each year. Indeed, records show that the fewer than 6% of water systems that broke the law were ever punished or fined by the EPA. In some instances, drinking water violations were one-time events and probably posed little risk, but for hundreds of other systems, illegal contamination persisted for years, and records show, according to the article, the Senate Environmental and Protection and Public Works Committee will question a high-ranking EPA official about why they allowed water companies to continue such contamination without punishment at a hearing today, And according to the study, not only were water systems contaminated with radioactive substances like uranium, as well as arsenic, but they were also found to contain cancer-causing solvents and illegal amounts of bacteria. The amount of radium detected in drinking water was 2,000% higher than the legal limit, adds the report. Radium is described as extremely radioactive and has a half-life of 1,602 years. People exposed to radium suffered serious health effects, including sores, anemia, and bone cancer. The use of radium in paints as late as 1950s was eventually halted after many deaths were attributed to exposure to the chemical. True to form, the New York Times chose to characterize water which contains deadly radioactive chemicals as dirty in its headline. Millions in U.S. drinking water, millions in U.S. drink dirty water, records show, was their headline. And oh, it's just a bit of dirt, you know. Cancer's causing radioactive toxins and poisonous arsenic. It's just a little dirty. The problem, say current and former government officials, is that the enforcing the Safe Drinking Water Act has not been a federal priority. Reports of the Times adding the current and former EPA officials who attempted to make the agency enforce the drinking water law were targeted. They proposed drinking water cases, but they got shut down so fast that I've pretty much stopped even looking at the violations, said one longtime EPA enforcement official, who, like others, requested anonymity for fear of reprisals. And the top people want big headlines and million-dollar settlements. That's not drinking water cases. So there you have it. According to the EPA, breathing is a threat to human health. But drinking water laced with arsenic, cancerous carcinogens, and radioactive chemicals is perfectly nutritious. So pour a fresh glass of toxic drinking water up and say cheers to the fact that the government really cares about our health and the real environmental issues before you drop dead. And that was by Paul Watson and Paul Joseph Watson and Prison Planet. Recommend you listen to that one. Let's see what else I got here. I got something else good. This is always good. The Tamiflu fraud. Scientists attempting to peer review the paper requested vital data and did not get it. Tonight we report a key plank of the evidence for Tamiflu's effectiveness is being called into question. The swine flu hit the UK, Britain. The antiviral drug Tamiflu hit the headlines, becoming the de facto first line of defense against the epidemic. It was lauded for reducing the length and duration of flu-like illnesses and, importantly, for reducing hospitalizations. Governments around the world stockpiled supplies. In the UK alone, the estimated bill for Tamiflu is approaching £500 million. And tonight, Channel 4 News can reveal the serious scientific questions being raised over the evidence based on Tamiflu. And let's see what they got here. Fortunately, they don't have a report. Scientists we have spoken to say that they are unable to judge and properly test some of the claims made about the antiviral by its makers, Roche. And claims about the drug's effectiveness in reducing hospitalizations have been a key factor in decisions by governments around the world to stockpile Tamiflu. A manufacturer, Roche, estimates the sales of Tamiflu this year will reach $1.6 billion. And, or pounds, rather, I'm sorry. Tamiflu benefits are well publicized. If I could say it reduces the chance of flu being transmitted in the first place, and as someone has become infected, it shortens the duration. Today, reviews confirm these findings. But the drug is also credited with reducing complications in hospitalization in those who believe it full-blown. Let's see, let me go through. This is a long article. But and without this study, the reviewers came to a stark conclusion. Dr. Jefferson told Channel 4 News, "We didn't find any convincing evidence that Tamiflu affects complications such as hospitalizations, chest infections, and leaves important questions about its effectiveness unresolved." She said, "I think we're now in a situation where the evidence based on Tamiflu is far from compelling, and really governments need to get to grips on this and to understand the truth around the evidence, given that this is a drug on which vast sums of money have been spent." So Tamiflu is a fraud. We knew this about a number of years ago when they tried to work with it on the avian flu. But Donald Rumsfeld had shares in that company and shares and helped get Tamiflu put through while he was chairman of Searle. And he's also responsible for aspartame and Tamiflu. So, great guy, this guy, Donald Rumsfeld. And let's see, we've got about 10 minutes left here. Fortunately, we don't have too much more. And here we go. Okay. ClimateGate. Barack Obama's rule by EPA decree is a coup d'etat against Congress made in Britain. Who needs tanks on the lawn when you have the Environmental Protection Agency? Barack Obama's use of the EPA to pressurize the Senate to pass this climate change Nuremberg decrees show his dictatorial mentality. He wants to override Congress, which is hostile to his climate gobbledygook, because it is representative of the American electorate and sideline the nation's elected senators by ruling by decree, courtesy of the EPA. This is a coup d'etat. I'll continue that in a second. And what is the justification for this undemocratic action? The allegedly imminent threat from anthropogenic global warming. There is always a supposed threat when tyrants take the stage. The President of the United States has just reduced his moral authority to the level of any third world dictator heading a government of national emergency. Fortunately, the world's leading democracy, which is trying to subvert his guarantees of liberty, so deeply embedded in its constitution that the U.S. citizens are well placed to fight back. In the first place, regulation can be challenged in a way that laws cannot. So the EPA's proposed ruling on so-called greenhouse gases can be opposed extensively with litigation, to the point that the ruling might not yet be enforced when Obama demits office. In the second place, the EPA is funded by Congress. So if the agency is being used to bypass or neuter Congress, why should legislators not play hardball and retaliate by cutting off its funding? The EPA may look formidable, but its situation is rather as if Rommel were buying the fuel for his tanks from the Allies. And let's see. But what is of compelling interest on this side of the pond, this is, of course, is written by a British writer, is the way in which the bullets are shoot down American democracy are made in Britain. The trail is not hard to follow. When the EPA published its endangered finding on greenhouse gases and proposed rule back in April, most every paragraph of the text, Federal Register, April 24, 2009, cited as authority the IPCC's 2007 report, which the agency acknowledges it relies on most heavily, and whence came the main input on climate change to that report. Yes, that's right. You've got it right, from Phil Jones, Michael Mann, and the rest of the lads at the CRU, East Anglia, from the innovative creative scientists who wanted to beat the crap out of a climate change skeptic who just completed Mike's nature trick, who can't account for the lack of warming at the moment, and it is a travesty that we can't, who deleted emails in the interest of science, who tried to prevent publications of dissenters' views, who coined the historic phrase, hide the decline. Those jokers are the main authority, the extravagant claims in the IPCC report, and by extension, for the EPA's endangered findings. That is the authority that is being invoked to overturn the principles of the 1776 in the United States. The protocols of the elders of Norwich are the justifications of EPA tyranny. It is with that weighty evidence at his back that Obama is going to Copenhagen to sell out American taxpayers to third world subsidy junkies, profiteering green corporations, and the ever-eternal Al Gore, ever-entrepreneurial Al Gore. This is the steal of the millennium. Forget the great train robbery and the Brinks Matt Caper. These hoodlums are targeting $45 trillion. Obama hates America, and increasingly that sentiment is being reciprocated. It is a socialist world government putsch that the American people, the resolution, have the American people the resolution to resist it, we shall soon know. Kind of frightening. Kind of a frightening scenario. I wonder if we're actually, headed that way. I don't know. Good question, though. If we are headed towards socialism, I don't know. But I think we are. I think we're already there. it's just a matter of time before it's totally revealed to us. And, we'll find it, figure it out. But hopefully before it's too late. I never thought of myself as a Republican. I never thought of myself that way. But I'm not a Republican, and I'm definitely not a globalist. But what I am is a liberal. I know that sounds strange to those out there, but a liberal is just somebody who believes in the good of mankind and believes that mankind should be good to one another as much as he can. But I'm not quite that altruistic, because I know that there are horrible, horrible people out there that are desperately trying to destroy this country and get as much from its people as it possibly can. And not only this country, I don't think they're... It just so happens that this country, the United States, has a little more money than most countries. But we also are a greedier nation than most countries. And for that, we suffer our plight. But I'm not certain if it's being appreciated what we do is being appreciated by the rest of the world in the same way, especially those poor, wretched people who don't have enough food or water to drink, even in our country, even in our in the United States, or who can't afford health insurance, who can't afford food, who can't afford clothing, for their children. I mean, it's just one big sick problem that's not going to go away. And, in fact, it will get worse. But the problem that exists is that these people are pushed aside. You know, they're not recognized. And that's the poverty, the 3 million, 4 million, 5 million homeless that we have now, and nobody really has a real estimate on how bad the situation really is. But it's there, and there can be no denying the whole situation, especially now with unemployment going so high, and it's just horrible. And we're in the 10%, and the only reason it dropped 10%, the 10% in this country, is because most people, probably another 5 or 10% of the people, fell off the unemployment rolls. Not because they got jobs, but because they ran out of unemployment, so they no longer counted. So, it's a terrible situation. But, again, that's the way it is. As we go into the Christmas season, I hope everybody... I wish everybody well. I hope they have enough food on their table. And enough clothes on their back and enough heat to stay warm. But I know there are many, many millions who don't, and not only in this country, but around the world. And it's for those people, primarily, and it's for that, the recognition of those people that I continue to do this silliness every night on radio and try to bring forward a understanding of what's really going on I'm so grateful that we've reached well over 41,000 listeners now, and for our work, and that people are listening, and whether or not at least they're being informed by what we're doing, and we're grateful for that. The other thing is that as we continue our struggle, and I say our struggle, then hopefully we'll have others who will feel less alienated, less alone, and knowing that other people are trying to do something as well to rectify the situation. We're not just jawing. Talking off the top of our heads. But as the hour approaches here, and I got about 40 seconds left of the show, I want to thank everybody for listening tonight. Sorry about the interview. We had a technical problem here. But I wanted to thank everybody for joining us who has, and if you could tell your friends about us, we'd appreciate it. And I hope you have a pleasant evening. And you can join us tomorrow. Join me tomorrow night as we venture into the spirit world and go into a little metaphysics. So thank you so much, and good night.